Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Unknown Universe Radio. Today is Saturday. Let me check the date here. It changes the date, so I have a little trouble with it. Today is Saturday, May 23rd, 144th day of 2020, and we have 222 to go until we get into a new year. And man, do we need a new year. The moon is waxing. The evening's planets are Mercury and Venus. The morning planets are Jupiter, Mars, Neptune, and bringing up the rear is Uranus. So, the first show of Unknown Radio in about a year and a half. And I had a little audio problems here at the very beginning. I thought I had everything worked out, but I didn't. But I do now, and just been spending a little time listening to all the problems all over the larger cities in the United States, listening to Chicago, State Street, Michigan Avenue's on fire. Every place is getting broken to and burglarized. But anyway, another little problem I have tonight is that I cannot, my eyes aren't working right. I cannot see very well tonight, and I do not know what the problem is. My eyes are clean. I rubbed them real well. I don't know what's wrong. But anyway, we got to get this show on the road because we had a lot to cover. We have a lot to cover tonight. We have a great guest on tonight, and I apologize. I cannot read his intro. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to get off here and introduce our guest and have him tell us a little bit about himself. Tonight's guest is Mr. Harry Drew, UFO researcher, and he lives in Arizona, where I want to go. Hey, Harry, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing all right, Jim. How are you?
I'm not doing too bad, except for not being able to see very well tonight. So still got the 100-plus degree weather out there in Arizona?
Actually, we had a cool day. It's about 90 right now.
Oh, that's nice and cool. That's very cool. Yeah, more than one way. All right, sir. You have been researching a very interesting UFO case from 1953. And it just happened to happen in Arizona, in the Kingman, Arizona area. And I guess it's a couple different crashes of UFOs. I hate to just jump right into this, but with the time that I've wasted, I'm afraid I have to do that. So can you give us a general idea of what happened there in May?
I can certainly do that. Actually, once you know about the story, it makes a lot of sense compared to all the stories that were made up for about 40 years about what happened or didn't happen. But basically, Kingman, Arizona, which is over in northwest Arizona, has a flight path, believe it or not, and all of the people out there who are listening, just ride along with me for a second, and I'll tell you why you might not believe it, but there's a flyway that goes from north to south, and the UFOs use that, and then those of us here see that, here being Kingman, Arizona area, and the Y4, there's reputedly a base they go to. So you think of it like it's an airport for shuttlecraft. These are atmospheric type of vehicles, not interstellar vehicles. And so they've been seen long before any of the listeners, including myself, were probably even aware of unidentified flying objects or stories about them. And quite frankly, they've been seen here for a very long time. And the first and only incident where an aggressive act was taken by UFOs against our species on the ground occurred in June of 1947, just ahead of the reported Roswell crash in July of 1947. And that happened at Kingman, Arizona. And that was the beginning instance of a sheriff here who was elected in 1945 and served 25 years in office before he passed away. And he had a career also chasing after reported incidences that were happening from UFOs. This was front page news before Roswell's story hit the paper in Roswell, New Mexico. There was multiple UFOs involved. So with that, I am former retired director of museums of history, anthropology, and archaeology. I participated in a lot of digs and all of the things that go along with that profession, an accredited director, and also a general curator. I had to be that to be able to manage staff that were professional in the various fields. When I retired, I came down from my mountain ranch in south central Oregon to the Kingman area, and I heard about the Kingman UFO. This goes back to 2006, so I decided, being I'm retired, that I would take on one more project on top of everything else, and I began doing research, and then I began doing field work, and I spent 6 years in the field. I interviewed the last known remaining eyewitnesses from the time. There would have been more done if somebody had done this 20 years before me, that had so many more resources. I also interviewed the last surviving member of the United States Air Force UFO retrieval team. And the gentleman was here with other Air Force personnel flown down from Nellis Air Force Base, which is located in Nevada, not far from Las Vegas. And they were sent down on the 18th day of May, 1953, for something that they had no idea at the time. They were responsible probably for downing the craft because of experiments with radar here with three units trying to boost the power. And I'm skipping over a lot of other things that we really don't have time for, that each one would take up the entire show. So they came, and at that point in time, for everyone to understand, in 1945, as World War II came to an end, the largest B-17 bomber training base in the world was in Kingman, and it shut down. The war was ending with Europe, and they were handing off more work for the new B-29 bomber and that kind of stuff. So this base closed in August of 1945 when the Army Air Corps, which preceded the U.S. Air Force, left.
Right.
There was no military in Kingman ever again. So that's important to know. So
okay.
When these individuals came, they also came with 20 military police because we didn't know, they didn't know, what went down here. And it went down southeast of Kingman. And when they arrived on approximately at the site that one of the radars, this UFO, actually flew past, when they arrived at the site, there was a craft sitting in pristine condition. It landed. It did not crash. And outside of it was, outside was waiting a crew. And during my interviews with the Air Force retrieval team member, he was 85 at the time, sharp as a tack mentally, and unfortunately passed away not long after that. But he told me things that only someone who lives here could know. And he also mentioned in passing, and I've interviewed hundreds of people during my career, he mentioned in passing something that was actually a landmark. And I had been everywhere, it seemed like, driving in the desert and the foothills of what's called the Hualapai Mountain, which is out at 8,256 feet high. It's timbered, has mountain lions and elk and all of the things. It looks like the Rockies. And it sits right in the Hualapai Valley next to Old Town Kingman, just stands up out of the valley floor. And he gave me something no one had ever heard of, and that was a clue about what to look for. And after doing about 20 square miles, I was ready for any clues I could get. And I found the object he mentioned. It's the only one like it here, anywhere. And I knew from an interview done by a researcher named Raymond Fowler back in Massachusetts, who did an interview with a man named Arthur G. Stansel Jr., who came out in a bus with scientists from them being flown into Phoenix, and they were put aboard an Army bus. And they came out the only road that came toward Kingman, and it had been a wagon road up until 1950. And they rode the bus for about 4 hours, and they were taken to inspect this thing on the 21st day of May, 1953. I have the 65 pages of the transcript from that, along with all the footnotes made by the county historian in Mojave County in 1978. That also helped me, along with all of the research and accredited museum archives, police files and records, contact the state of Arizona Highway Department, find out where the roads were, when they started doing construction and things, so that the bus
right.
could feasibly make it here, and it did. And it was a Model 3301 General Motors bus, one of 840 that were built for the Army. And so I have the report on that, and he talks about the crafts being not only not a dent, It didn't have even a scratch on the saucer. And the crew was immediately removed and taken to Groom Lake, that we call roughly that area we call Area 51. And they were immediately evacuated out of there because they were not in need of any repairs. They were completely in good condition, but they're top secret. And they cleared out anyone off this 1912 wagon road. Pardon me. And so while I'm digesting all of that, I thought I had found the information I needed. I found the site. What I did is I pulled up with my Jeep, and it was about 105 degrees, Jim. And my window is down, and I look out as I pull up, and I'm right next to me is the field kitchen where the military was for 3.5 days. And what they left behind was still there.
Wow.
Wow. Identifiable things like that there. Experimental.
Yeah, exactly. So something happened there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It verified, one, the military was there because of experimental items that were left there that were made under contract by the military, one-of-a-kind thing, pardon me, on one of them, and there were hundreds. And the area was laid out to where it still showed sign, still showing sign in desert country, as long as it's not in a wash, that type of thing. There's very little erosion, as you well know. So we have interesting peaks and rock formations and all of this that have lasted for hundreds of thousands of years. And this is only pushing 70 years. And so here are these places, including the stationed military police on all four corners of an area that they quadrant off. And the military police set up a roadblock on this 1912 wagon road further to the north. And they met up with the sheriff and the undersheriff coming from Kingman because they had brought equipment for doing recovery work that had been loaded on flat cars and brought in 4 miles short of Old Town and offloaded. And they brought an M25 tank transporter with 38-foot trailer and booms and various other things they were needing to be able to lift this thing without causing any damage to it. And they went through town. 3,400 people, if you could get all the miners in a town, was the population then. The town was 6 blocks long. And so they went rumbling through, and the sheriff got calls, and the sheriff went out. And the first thing that happened is they met up with the military police roadblock. They tried multiple times to get around or get them to bring a commander or something, and they refused. And he told that story to the day he died, the other stories that he had. And his granddaughter was telling the same stories just a few years ago, she was that I'm aware of, and where she's telling other people, which is perfectly fine. It happened. So that's I thought I was all done. And then a museum curator for a military aviation museum approached me and started telling me about a UFO crash that he had been tipped off about 25 years ago. And he gave me details that were hard to just resist listening to. And I said, listen, would you mind hopping in my rig and direct me out there and we'll go. And so we picked up a local who was with the city of Kingman, and we went out to this location, and we had to hike out to where this spot was. And temperatures were again pretty warm. For us, it's normal, but He had done everything he could, including having boarding a light aircraft to fly over the area, and he couldn't find anything. And the problem was, because of some precipitation, the desert instantly grows everything it possibly can, because it's not going to get another chance until it rains again someday. And so the brush, low brush, that was here and there incidentally, made it difficult for me to read the ground terrain, and so and for him. So I saw some things that kind of caught my attention, but this was getting a little bit tough to buy into, because I just found the only one I'd ever heard about, the Kingman UFO landing, which was not a crash, which changed the dynamics a lot. And so I got with a man who is a scientist and was working on the Mariana Trench dive for James Cameron, and the dive that Cameron would do. And he went with Cameron to keep calibrating the ROV and things going down 7 miles into the Mariana Trench. And so he stopped his work for me because he had a drone, and I needed somebody who knew how to fly a drone, mainly, to come up and put my cameras on it and let me do an overfly of the landing site and all of the periphery area, and then go down to this place that was in what we call Red Lake. It's the Red Lake Desert, which is north of Kingman. And so we did flights anywhere from 10 feet to 50 feet over the entire area, but specifically a couple of places that I really felt there had been a disturbance that had happened that's not natural. And after all of that, I did in fact find the impact area where a saucer-shaped craft ricocheted off of a rocky butte and traveled 0.21 miles before it crashed into the desert floor in the Red Lake Desert. Then the details that I got from that were rather astounding after doing more interviews. And the local people, just so everybody understands this, long before Las Vegas had this idea, the local people here lived under a undeclared martial law during World War II. They had blackouts and the whole thing that happened during world wars. And they also had a tendency not to talk to outsiders, and the Army Air Corps made sure that that was a way of life, and they were very supportive and patriotic, so they did that. And there was no change that way until the late 70s, 1970s. But so what people saw in Kingman, news about it stayed in Kingman, and that was a remarkable thing. And I had befriended a good number of seniors, old timers that lived here from that time, some who were well aware of it, some others who were eyewitnesses, and I attended luncheons that were semi-private, as far as they weren't open to a group or something. And these would come up casually in conversations, which stunned me that I was hearing about other things besides just one UFO. And there's so much involved in the first story and the recovery. It would take several shows just to cover, you know, how you get to this point. A lot of time and hard work, most of it boots on the ground, actually going out. Anything that came my way, if it didn't check out in the field, I left, because there's all kinds of things that were told that have no even semblance of being factual, which is too bad. because it's a disservice for maintaining the accurate history, which is part of what historians do, so that 400 years from now, everything going correctly, people would hear the right story instead of one of the gee whiz ones. So I went out to the site knowing at Red Lake where from the overhead flights where things were, and sure enough, they certainly were. And the history behind that is that the craft was on the same flyway coming from the north, flying south. The only thing at the end of that little flight distance of maybe 15 miles is that it takes them the direction of the underground base. Aircraft carriers were used for the Navy. Fighter jets can also fly and land on a field, on land, an airfield. And so it was kind of like that. And we're told here, and we see them, or what we're told of them. I've never been aboard any of these things, so I can't tell you if they would agree with our interpretation. But the crafts that sit fairly high and hover sometimes maybe down to 800 feet, and they're motherships. You ever heard the term mothership? And so that's what they use. In our vernacular, we call it a carrier. And so they have a couple of options to where and how they could go. But at Red Lake, hitting the Rocky Butte, and there's ejecta, the rocks and dirt and everything that were hit way back when, were blown forward from the impact as it ricocheted off the upper portion, very almost top of the butte, and left an arc. The saucer-shaped arc where it cut in, and then where it augured in is plain right now. And in fact, where it augured in and it came to a stop, there's nothing growing there still right now, which I thought was rather amazing as well. But two of the crew suffered lower extremity injuries and were rushed to Nellis, where they died at the infirmary, and two others that were roughed up but were in satisfactory condition were taken on to Groom Lake, wherever the other four went, because that part of the information I've not been able to get away from the Air Force. I don't think anybody has that would dare mention it in public. And I'll say this, too. It's important for everyone to realize that there's a ton of things and hours of conversation about what happened and who did what. The crew members were described in the next thing that happens in a very unusual way. I thought it was all done. I really thought it was all done. And an archivist walked over to me in an archive, and she handed me a document and walked away, kind of looking off at the walls and ceiling, and like she had never done that. And I looked at this document, and it was unbelievable. And I met with the head of security from Mojave County Court, because I had not been able to find the original sheriff's office from that era. And my expectation was after 60 years, it would be torn down. And that's what they told me. So I just accepted it. Then I said, I want to know where it is so I can go to the site and look around and see what may have existed at the time, because there may be some superfluous thing where they saw what happened on the 24th day of May, 1953. When down people in Old Town, in plain view of people in Old Town, watched a flying disc fall from the sky and hit the north face of the Hualapai Mountain and set it on fire in front of everybody. And then volunteers began assembling as fast as they could, because this is timbered mountains. It was 16 miles from a sawmill, and they rushed up there and began the setting up for a fire. They had large round galvanized tubs they filled with water and soaked gunny sacks in it to beat the grass fire. And other guys were out there with shovels and dirt. And the Forest Service showed up with some employees who had the new breast tank you wear on the back with water and soda, and it had a little black rubber hose with a breath pump. So it was kind of like an oversized water gun. And those were the main tools they were using at waiting for a bulldozer. And the Forest Service worker who had just come back with more things for the volunteers that were assembling as fast as they could go, noticed right near the source of where the fire had started, and it had already spread and was heading up the side of the mountain, noticed two individuals who were wandering around like they were disoriented or lost or something, but they didn't belong there. Mm-hmm. And he went over to talk to them, and they wouldn't talk to him. They wouldn't answer any questions. And there was a news reporter there who was writing down in a little notepad different things he saw for a fire that would burn out of control for 2 weeks, and the governor sent the National Guard down to help fight it. It was bad. And he sees this, and the two individuals became suspects for arson, and they were taken into custody by county lawmen. And the two of them, as they went by the news reporter, the reporter wrote down two, this is a quote, two strange-looking men. And they were wearing some type of coverall, flight suits. They were taken to a interrogation facility in the basement of the 1915 Mojave County Courthouse, which still exists. It's on the National Register of Historic Sites. And the lower portion of the building is used for court activity in regard to cases the court handles, and it's off-limits to the public for 35 years. And that's how I ended up with the head of security for the Mojave County Court. And he took me, after I went over things with this document that I got, he took me, and we walked over, and he shut off an alarm. We went through a door. He turned the alarm back on, turned off another one. We stepped through another door, and I was in the 1953 Mojave County Sheriff's Office, right down to an oak chair beside the door to what they called then the interrogation room, which was far more than that, and it was a concrete steel-reinforced vaults with one door that opened, locked, and it opened out into the sheriff's office with three armed deputies. And, of course, they're behind two locked doors just to get in the sheriff's office. And interestingly enough, they were taken there. The sheriff was not in. It's a little bit like Mayberry, USA. And came in back then, and he's off someplace, and they sent a deputy to find him. The deputy comes back with the sheriff, the Forest Service worker, and another man briefed the sheriff, and he told him to open up because they were right. He wanted to interview these two. There's a massive fire burning. And they stepped into the room, and there was nobody there. And in the newspaper, because the reporter followed everybody down to the sheriff's office, and the newspaper man wrote, and they vanished. And the peculiar thing about that is that the sheriff, unlike some other occasions, didn't call for an APB, close down all the roads, search the courthouse, search the grounds. It's like he just turns to one of the the fellows there on saying, what are you having for Sunday's dinner? It was just like, and he had learned since 1947 that chasing these folks that are coming in by saucers isn't very productive, and in fact tends to backfire. And there are others that I'll mention later, and some other writings that I'm doing that I found because I went back in time to try to find when the first roads were here. So I was back looking at maps that date back to 1857, and then I walked forward. And the reason I did that is because, one, I was still looking at the Kingman UFO as being only one thing. There were stories about how it was taken down Highway 40, and the Highway 40 was closed from Kingman, Arizona, going to the west to Barstow, California. That's 206 miles. And all the side roads onto 40 from the desert were closed, and the UFO was taken down Highway 40 and down a road, Highway 68, and crossed a bridge over the Colorado River going west, and then up the hill to get to Highway 95 north in Nevada to go to Grim Lake. And all of that is just an impossibility. And when I checked on the maps, what I found was that whoever said they had done research and wrote stories like that didn't bother actually to do the research, because Highway 40, we all know, is Interstate 40, and it was constructed 31 years after the Kingman UFO had landed. And so it's like nobody took Highway 40. And if that wasn't a big enough issue, there was no bridge over the Colorado at all for them to do that. And it just kept going like that. And so part of this has been to dispel what is and what isn't. And without sounding like leaning on the what isn't, but it's astounding how many stories have been manufactured and the things that I have found outweigh and are far more stunning than all of the stories combined that don't fit. I have acquired the largest collection of information regarding the UFO events, the Kingman UFO, the Red Lake UFO crash, and the UFO that crashed into the north face of the Wall of Fire. And I call it a new book, I call it 7 Days in May, The Kingman UFO Story. And it's filled, the first book, which is meant for universities and libraries and museums, is 22 inches wide. It's archival, full color, and it's full of photos shot in the field. And it's the kind of things that universities and museums and libraries can actually put to good use. And it walks right straight through showing sites that exist, but are off. Some of it's off limits now, and with good reason, because theft happens, like the alleged crash site for Roswell. I don't think there's a twig on top of a pebble left there in a 1 square mile area. That's just what happens. So,
yeah. Kind of keep that stuff, kind of hard to keep that stuff clean when you have tours going out there and everything. It makes it rough. Now, when all this happened, Area 51, they opened, or it came into existence, what, around 1955?
Yes and no.
Was the wreck... Okay, good. That's my question.
No. Let me explain. There's a lot of things that happened that were fortuitous for what happened here to get them, get the things and get out of here with them. And they did it. They took the craft. They took There was an air base here. The Air Force knew exactly what's on the ground. They flew over it every time they went out of the base and came into the base. It was constant for years during World War II, and maybe and before that, and since they fly over like they fly over everywhere else in Arizona, the Air Force and all the really interesting things that exist right now that we get to see and can't really describe too well, but. The thing to remember here is that in 1951, Groom Lake, the facility at Groom Lake, was handed over to Edwards Air Force Base, okay, to use as an annex. And I think you've been around long enough and you're studious and an intelligent guy, and you know that the military, different branches, uses dark money, okay? Oh, it's like, it's not a high-profile budgeted amount, and that didn't happen until 1955. So, you follow what I'm saying on that?
Yes, I do.
The funds for developing this. Some of this stuff was handed off to Indian Springs Air Force Base up at Groom Lake. But they began the development of what we call Area 51. In fact, the Cayman UFO is the actual UFO the entire Area 51 UFO story is based on. It was taken there intact, and they used the desert roads that existed then and exist now, the same ones that take it right up to Hoover Dam. And the Army Corps of Engineers had already brought stuff up via Camp Irwin, okay, before it was called Fort Irwin, which in 1951, also the same year, a big transition happened with the military in 1951. Camp Irwin was infantry-oriented. Their training and their entire purpose was infantry until 1951, and then it was transitioned immediately into armor. That's where the M25, 40-ton M25 tank transporter and trailer came from, and the heavy lift equipment, and they loaded it on flat cars, and they sent it straight down, and it offloaded on the southwest side of Old Town Cayman. I've been right to the spot. You know, I've talked with folks at the camp. So these types of things, you have to know some of the on-the-ground reality things that went on. And Edwards began building what would become Area 51 before money was budgeted in 1955, and it really was budgeted in 1955, but they didn't stand around twiddling their thumbs. They had revenue that was off the books as far as arguing over in the halls of Congress, and that's the way it works even still.
Okay. Now, you know, this the crash, you know, the way you describe it, where it came in, hit the butte, and, you know, buried itself in the ground, that sounds almost exactly like the Socorro, New Mexico crash, where it bounced off of a butte, left a big old scar in the side of it, and, you know, and buried it in. And also with all of the townspeople going up there to see what was going on, there was also a fire with that. So that's, What is it with out west, mm-hmm. with let's say New Mexico, Arizona, and Nevada, that aircraft, wherever they're from, don't seem to fly very well?
Are you asking me who said why they're here? Is that what you're asking?
It just seems like that they have trouble getting through these three states without crashing. A lot of, you know, we got Roswell, we got Socorro, we got the Kinks. Be a lot of
there's
crashes.
A line that runs from Roswell right to here. I'll tell you this. I had a scientist say almost exactly to me what you just said about, but instead of using Socorro, they used Roswell. And
okay.
But I was on for 3 hours, okay? And so I could go through this step by step, which takes time, and even then doesn't cover it. That's why it's got a new film is being anticipated where this can be something that people can sit down and watch. I've already got two things that I've done just to try to satisfy people because they wanted something tangible to see, and I didn't have it. When I first talked about this as a guest, the special featured speaker for MUFON's International Symposium, and which is another issue and a kind of an exciting opportunity and all of that. But the problem here I had when the scientist said, you know, this sounds, you've got more information, speaking to me. You have more information than what's being said about Roswell. And he said the other thing is there are so many parallels with Roswell. And all I can tell you is this, and I can repeat it for you if you'd like. The Roswell books, the stories written about Roswell in 1980, and right after that, another one. Those books were written after the principal people involved had a chance to hear about the April 1973 interview done by Raymond Fowler with a scientist and engineer and mathematician. He was a physicist as well, Arthur G. Stansel Jr., who was here with the craft. Who touched the craft, who was escorted like the others on the bus. Each one had a name called on a roster and were escorted to the craft 50 feet from the bus by military police, okay? They were allowed with 20 minutes to be with the craft to verify something that their expertise only could answer. And that went to the government, okay? This was not an experimental U.S. Air Force plane. Okay, or they wouldn't have driven them four hours from Phoenix to Kingman, and they'd have taken them to a hangar.
They already knew that, so they wouldn't have had done that.
Yeah, so unfortunately, things get a little complicated, and I don't know if I can even get the best way to say some of these things without sounding malicious or something. But the people who followed the story and then followed the April 1976 story by Fowler, Raymond Fowler, who's a very excellent researcher, by the way, who did a story in UFO magazine, and that was 4 years before the Roswell books were written, okay? The other was 7 years, 1973. So the similarities between storyline, and I have, where during that period in time, back in the 70s, I have statements from some of these people, and even their pictures that, as they were appeared, they were interviewed and asked about, what's your interest, do you have any interest about this? The story just came out about Kingman and all that. And, of course, they said, and do we ever? Yes. You know, so the scientists were saying, how come, why is there a similarity between Roswell and Kingman? Well, maybe because the Kingman story was out first.
That makes perfect sense.
Maybe. Perfect. You know.
Yeah. Man, I'm gonna have to have you back on again can finish this story. But can you tell people your website and the name of your book and how they can get a hold of it? Well, I know it's a DVD also, so what can you tell us about that?
Well, the book is being the hardbound 22-inch one is being held back, and that goes to libraries and that type of thing. And that hasn't been a general public release thing. The softbound follows that, and I'm waiting on the production of I'm the filmmaker, okay, amongst the things I do. I'm an internationally known artist and other things as well as a historian, as you know, published. You can find it on Amazon, some of the things, and the other new ones that are coming. But Kingman UFOs, let's see, www.kingmanufocrashes.com will take you to the website, which will be updated again soon, and it gives you more about what I'm talking about, gives you photos so you can get a grasp of what it is. I can tell you that all of this is as told to me during interviews, and I went out, boots on the ground, and I checked for these places or any of the clues, and I found what they were talking about. If I didn't find something, I left the field. There's a lot of other things I had to do for the project, and this has been on me. My work, my funds, my interest, and the expertise that I have in museology and archaeology, anthropology, those things were applied uniformly and professionally so it can withstand scrutiny and come back with something that you can get a hold of and enjoy. And
exactly.
And the museums and different places in Old Town are waiting to get copies of my work.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on in the very near future. And hopefully later this year, we'll be able to meet up and maybe have some sort of adventure or something.
Oh, I guarantee it, Jim.
Can't wait. So that's KingmanUFOCrashes.com. And our guest tonight was Harry Drew. Harry, thanks again. And you have a great rest of your evening out there, and definitely try to stay cool.
Thank you, and stay safe, everyone.
Yes, that's the name of the man. Thank you very much, sir. All right, real quick here. Next week's guest is going to be one of the participants of the Rendlesham UFO encounter in England, Mr. John Burroughs. He'll be my guest next week. You guys have a great evening. Love y'all. Stay safe. And, you know, do what you can. Pulling this together, they say. Good night.